And welcome. Welcome to another in a series of conference calls that bring you closer to the work that your support of World Wildlife Fund makes possible. I'm Kimberly Marchant, and I'm a member of the field program team here at WWF, and I'll be moderating the call today. Before we get going, I want to thank you on behalf of all of us here at World Wildlife Fund for your commitment to our work and to our mission. So we're talking today with Carter Roberts, President and CEO of World Wildlife Fund, and Carter will discuss the big issues from the past year, and in particular our wildlife crime campaign, as well as provide a sense for where the organization and conservation is headed in 2013. We're also going to be joined by Crawford Allen, director of our wildlife trade program called TRAFFIC. But before we get started, just a few points on logistics. As I've already asked, we ask that you mute your phones unless you're ready to ask a question. Either use the mute function on your phone or dial *6. When you're ready to ask a question, press *6 again to unmute your phone. There will be three Q&A sessions throughout the call. And during each of these, you may ask your question in one of three ways. If you'd like to ask directly on the phone, state your name and where you're calling from before asking your question. And you can also email your question to calls@wwfus.org. That's calls@wwfus.org. Additionally, you may ask your questions via Twitter at WWFcalls. That's at WWFcalls. And if you're sending your question electronically, you can do so at any time, and our panelists will respond during the next available Q&A session. So the call is scheduled to last an hour, and I'll make sure that we wrap things up on time. Carter, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Kimberly. And thanks, everybody, for being on the call. It has been a busy year, like every year, and we've had a lot of challenges that we face. The interesting part about our work is there are a sea of opportunities for us to act, and one of the greatest challenges we have is prioritizing where we put our efforts. And one of the areas that is of increasing importance and concern is the illegal wildlife trade. It has this is an area where we have felt really good about our progress over the past two or three decades, where we've seen the numbers go down year after year after year in terms of rhinos poached, elephants poached, and thought we had the situation stabilized in Africa. But particularly in the past 3 years, we've seen that trend line reverse course and accelerate sharply. So in South Africa, for instance, the average year we saw about 20 rhinos poached for a long, long, long time. It was a straight, flat line. And in the year 2008, it climbed to 83, then to 122 in 2009, then to 333 in 2010, to 448 in 2011. And this year, we are on course to top 600. And that is a trend line going in the wrong direction. We also are seeing tens of thousands of elephants killed every year for their ivory. And this is a situation that's getting worse, not better. So we determined that this year we would put the hammer down on a global campaign using social media, using our relationships, using our engagement with governments around the world to raise awareness and also to drive specific commitments and actions to make a difference and to interrupt this trade, to catch the bad guys, and to take that trend line and turn it back in the other direction. And I was just at the State Department yesterday on a live webcast with embassies from around the world. I think we had over 20,000 people viewing with questions from Zambia, from Liberia, from Japan, all around the world, and we are really encouraged by some of the progress that we're making and the commitments by key governments, most particularly our own. Hillary Clinton has made this one of the signature issues in her the last months of her time at the State Department. I was tweeting back and forth with Chelsea yesterday about this campaign, And we've had some terrific commitments made by governments and by the private sector. And this is a good time for me to introduce Crawford Allen, who has led our joint effort with IUCN called TRAFFIC, which is kind of a wildlife trade Interpol, an institution that tracks the issues, tracks the trade, and drives for commitments on an international basis. Crawford can tell us where we are in our work and also about some spectacular good news that we announced yesterday. Crawford.
Crawford, are you there? You can press star 6 to unmute your phone.
And thank you, Carter, and thank you all on the phone. I'm calling you from Mountain View, California, the home of Google. I just wanted to say that, you know, as you heard from Carter, with the killings increasing every year, we really need some strong solutions that can tackle these complexities of these terrible threats that we're facing. And we've got to push this envelope in fighting wildlife crime, absolutely. The poachers are unbelievable in what they're doing in stepping up their game, and now so do we have to face those challenges in the same sort of high level of impact that they're having. I'm here at Google because Google has just yesterday awarded WFUS a $5 million Global Impact Award grant. And this grant is really, really innovative, and it's going to help us test and integrate some new technologies to combat wildlife crime. I'm going to be leading this three-year project, and we're going to focus down initially on four sites in Africa and in Asia. And it's going to integrate some cutting-edge and readily replicable technologies. I mean, we're going to include things like using aerial surveillance systems, unmanned systems that are automatic. We're going to use low-cost and replicable wildlife tagging technology on animals. And we're going to put in place some analytical approaches that are going to help wildlife patrolling and ranger to be far more efficient and to integrate the way that they gather information with other systems internationally about wildlife crime and trafficking, so we can kind of try and deal with the problem from source consumer on the trade chain. So this is an exciting experiment, and it really aims to create a kind of umbrella, if you like, an umbrella of technology that's going to overarch efforts by governments to protect their wildlife from what basically are global crime syndicates that are driving this poaching and trafficking. And in fact, we're seeing more and more now that even armed militias are doing this to fund their operations, and some of those armed militias are linked to terror groups like Al-Qaeda. Basically, we're going to set up a tag system that will let us know where the animals are. We're going to know where those animals are through the tag system. We're going to know where the poachers are through surveillance systems. And we're going to be able to deploy ranger patrols in a rapid way to keep one step ahead of the poachers. Now, this is going to also have a strong deterrent effect. We're going to catch poachers, but also the poachers are going to be aware they're being monitored from both the air and the ground, that we're going to know they're going to know that the animals are being tracked, and hopefully they're going to realize that this is a very risky business they're involved with, and hopefully that it's just too risky for them to be involved in for the future.
Thank you, Crawford. That is exciting. And exciting that we have new means of and ways to enhance species protection. But I'm sure many of us are asking, when will it end? And how can we stop the trafficking that's driving the poaching? And what's WWF doing about that?
Yeah, Kimberly, thanks. You're right. You know, even with this amazing enhanced detection and deterrence process on the ground we're going to deploy, we need to come together in partnerships to really address the social drivers that are exploding this consumer demand, largely in Asia, driven by growing wealth. Wealth is a good thing. But unfortunately, a lot of people are seeing using wildlife as symbol as prestige, so rhino horn, ivory statues, tiger skin rugs, and so on. And we have to have a strategy. And so we developed this strategy working with people in Asia, with experts in Asia, to understand what is driving demand and how we can tackle it. We've just finished a 4-point plan to try and reduce that demand and make it unacceptable in countries like China and Vietnam to buy and consume endangered species. Some great events recently with a Fuller symposium, which WWF hosted in Washington recently, and an expert workshop on wildlife crime too, where we brought together thought leaders around these issues about combating wildlife crime and we heard from various experts. And on the issue of reducing demand in Asia for illicit wildlife products, we had an expert called Eric Fu, who is a marketer. He's an expert on marketing and PR in China. And he's been one person who's been really instrumental in helping us developing this strategy on how we respond in Asia. But ultimately, you know, through these events, we realized that some of the challenges of the militias and instability in poor governments are really putting wildlife crime onto the security agenda now. And in fact, even Secretary Clinton herself has called for a U.S. Intelligence review to determine the significance of wildlife crime that's both funding and fueling this civil unrest and even terrorism. And that's something else we need to explore and get involved with. And we are giving more and more information now to help with that issue right now. So I think that I'll leave it there, Kimberly.
Right. So Carter, I'd like to turn to you and just ask maybe for some more examples of how it is that we are building political will and what WBF is doing to engage.
Yeah, you know, I think, so first of all, every single part of our network is engaging their country leaders on this issue, whether that's WWF Netherlands, WWF Malaysia, WWF Zambia, and so on. Because at the end of the day, the most important thing is country-level leadership to stamp out this issue, stamp out this crime. I was in Zambia 3 weeks ago meeting with the Minister of the Environment. That weekend, they'd lost 100 elephants. They were calling an emergency meeting of the government to look at the possibility of mobilizing their military to do something about that now because their parks authority was too weak. The last day of our trip, I just witnessed this spectacle of a wild dog treeing a leopard and her cub, and the conflict between those two, the cats and the dogs. And when we left to go back to the plane to come home, we dropped off the scientist we were with, who met the Botswana military in helicopters to go off and monitor rhino trade and rhino poachers on Chiefs Island in the Okavango. This will require not just the private sector, but also the government and also civil society to get after the set of issues. And so we have to work at every single level. I would say that I am really encouraged by what African leadership has done in places like Namibia, where rhino populations are increasing, in places like Botswana, where the president is hardcore about this issue and mobilizing all the resources, and in Gabon, where the president led a burning ceremony of 10,000 pounds of ivory this past year. So I'm really encouraged by that. I think we have a lot of work to do in Asia. When I look at the level of response we've gotten from Vietnam and from Thailand, we need more. China is beginning to take steps to mobilize their police force and confiscate goods. But clearly we have to work both in the source countries and in those countries that are the ultimate ones that are buying the product. And we have to work at both levels. This is going to be one of the hardest things we have to do, but it's also going to be one of the measures of our worth as an organization, our ability to grab the world's imagination and to change the course of events.
Thank you, Carter, and thank you, Crawford. So let's go ahead and take our first opportunity for some questions. If you're asking your question directly, we ask that you state your name and where you're located before asking your question, and remember to press *6 to unmute your phone. As a reminder, you can also email your questions to calls@wwfus.org or ask your question via Twitter using @WWFcalls. For those of you who are not asking a question, you can press *6 to mute your phones. Does anyone on the phone have a question?
I do.
Great. State your name and where you're calling from. Thank you.
My name is Gail Bell. I'm calling from Denver, Colorado. And I don't know if everybody saw, but last week CBS News with Scott Pelley did an expose on the killing and slaughtering of elephants. They mentioned it again last night on the news. And I have also written to 60 Minutes because they've done exposés like this before. So I wanted to know if any of you guys are talking to people like 60 Minutes, because it's unbelievable the number of people that they reach. And I think making people aware in the world that this is going on is extremely important. I think most people don't even know about this, but when you can reach, you know, 20, 30 million people with something like this, it makes a huge difference.
You know.
Thank you, Gail. Carter?
You're welcome.
Gail, I think if you look at our media department, I think that they spend at least half of their time on this, reaching out to all the major media outlets and driving stories on this issue. National Geographic just featured the elephant killings on the cover of their, I think it was their September issue.
Yes.
You're right about just about every major media outlet is covering this now. Crawford is spending much more time than I am on this. Crawford, can you provide some details of the kind of media outreach that we're doing?
Yeah, thanks, Carter. There is so much interest now, and I think that, you know, the caller very, very welcomes that comment. It's absolutely right, and we do need to get the message out. And, of course, let's face it, you know, the place where we really need to get this message out is not just in the U.S., and, in fact, we're working more and more now to try and get this message strongly put forward within the media in Asia as well, to try and work along the trade chain and get all those people involved, from the source to the consumer, aware of the challenges, aware of the threats to elephants, but also the links to more broader agendas and make them prioritize this up to a more serious level, a higher level in political will, which is why we're saying that wildlife crime is a serious crime as the main push of our campaign. Now, there's a number of media efforts going on. We're just going to see more and more of this happening. I don't want to preempt anything that we're already working on and saying what's coming out right now, because they're not quite finalized. But there's no doubt that you will just see, particularly with this campaign driving as driving media, as Carter has said, more and more stories. And we are looking for bigger and better placements of stories within Asian media. So it's kind of a watch this space. We can definitely keep people informed of things as they're coming on in advance. So we can send people out. We can send that information through Twitter and Facebook and others to can alerts to folks about more information as it comes forward.
Yeah, I think Crawford nailed it. The real issue is in Asia. You know, we produced a public service announcement with our board member, Leonardo DiCaprio. We have collaborated with groups like Wild Aid that have produced all kinds of pieces featuring Chinese celebrities talking about why this is uncool. One of our board members, Singer Rankin, and her son Peck produced a documentary that and we were part of a CNBC piece earlier this year, and we have been driving with Congress new appropriations to address wildlife trade using the U.S. military, their training of other countries and their ability to enforce and put boots on the ground and monitor actions. And so we're acting in all those ways. But it is true that ultimately, unless we change the way Vietnamese and Chinese and Thai look at rhino horns and tiger bones and elephant tusks, we are not going to change. We're not going to change the trajectory. One rhino horn, the average rhino horn weighs 6 kilos. It sells on the open market in Vietnam for $100,000 per kilo. So one rhino horn is worth $600,000. That will drive all kinds of white collar and crime and all kinds of corruption at every level of just about any government. So we have to address it on the ground in Vietnam, where it's less of a traditional medicine item. It's more of a prestige item, where people who can afford to want to show off by using it, grinding it up, putting it into cocktails as a hangover cure, as an aphrodisiac, all kinds of ways it's being sold. We have to change the way the public sees it on the ground in Vietnam and China and Thailand. And that's the next big area of action for us.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and take another question from the call.
Hi, Kimberly. Hi, thank, Could I make one suggestion or just question for and Carter, Crawford, and yourself? This is Jeff Netterball in Madison, Wisconsin, with the Race Against Extinction. Is there any thought of putting a, you know, I'm you guys play nicely. I'm thinking the only way you can impact this in some of these Asian nations is in the wallet, and if there was a boycott on travel to these countries, maybe then you'd have a lot of people within these nations rise up against the demand because it's hurting their local economies.
Yeah, well, you know, it's I just traveled to that part of the world as well, and I think I think we have to look hard at what really motivates people in those countries to buy or not buy these items. They are black market items. They are it's a shadowy world, and in some cases involves government officials. WWF is not in the business of advocating trade sanctions. We or even travel sanctions. We are in the business of providing good science and being really clever about mounting campaigns to get the world to people to see the world in a different way. I think that's what we need to do in Vietnam and Thailand and China. And the more engagement there, the better. So.
Thank you, Carter. And Crawford, maybe I can tip that to you because also Stephen via email asked a similar question when he, asking a little bit of what you've already addressed of what we're doing to disrupt or stop illegal and illicit ivory markets, and then what WWF is doing once we identify those routes and the countries that sustain illegal and illicit markets. So, Crawford?
Yeah, thank you to Stephen. That's a great question. And there is so much going on this issue. I mean, we've got a number of areas that we need to approach. One area that we're doing is when, you know, we have been working for decades on the ivory trade issue. And, in fact, recently things have escalated to such a level that we are working through the CITES processes, which is the international treaty that deals with wildlife trade globally and has 180 member governments. There is an initiative now to push forward potentially a lot of pressure through the CITES system, and there will be a very important meeting coming up in March of 2013 in Bangkok where this issue will come to the fore, and it won't be necessarily us putting pressure on these governments. It's the governments themselves have woken up to the information we're providing, and through the CITES process, they are putting pressure on governments like Thailand who have a blatant loophole in their legislation. The market is there. It's open. People can buy ivory. A lot of the ivory is being bought by American tourists who are traveling there. And there's a very vast black market that could easily be closed down with better regulation on the ground and more legislation to close the loophole. And I think CITES is going to put on a lot of pressure on Thailand because Thailand is actually hosting the meeting. And whilst it may be a bit embarrassing to kind of, in the CITES process, to bash Thailand, it's something that I think is going to happen. But, you know, that's one area is obviously the legislation and the policy side. But we are working closely on the ground in monitoring these markets, and we are working with the governments themselves. And we have to encourage them to take action. But as Carter says, in some countries it's very difficult when the people involved are actually corrupt officials. But, so, you know, there are a number of ways you can deal with corruption, and that's something we could come on to a bit later perhaps. But there's also a lot greater need for resources on the ground. And, you know, we're working in countries to identify illicit markets, but they don't have the resources themselves to do on-the-ground investigations. They don't do inspections of markets. They don't have sniffer dogs. They don't have x-ray scanners of sea containers at the ports. They have very little training. And what we're hoping is that with a high-level push through our campaign and with people who are champions like Secretary of State Clinton, that we will start to see this top-down approach where they start to open the coffers to allow them to do these, some of these necessary things with our assistance and technical expertise. But also we're leveraging other funding as well. So we're helping to leverage resources like the Google grant to help governments to take action. There's a new growing area of work that needs to be addressed, certainly on the ivory markets, and that is much more in engaging the intelligence communities around the world as we are now seeing they are waking up to the fact and they're finding some smoking guns that are showing that the funding flows from the ivory trade and rhino horn trades are going to some very sinister dark places. Some of the worst criminal syndicates on the planet and even terrorist groups. And so they're starting to engage us now, and they're finding that they've got very little information, and that the civil society groups like WWF and Traffic are the ones that have information that can really help them. So we're investing a lot of time and effort in helping them build a picture so that they can use their much more far-reaching powers and authorities around the world to take action on the ground, to break the trade chains, to close down the markets, to root out corruption, and take it all and give a really strong punch in the face, basically, to the organized crime syndicates that are running the show, actually, and running rings around many governments. So that's some of the things. Yeah.
A question also coming from California. Is the U.S. also a market for ivory? And what are we, WWF U.S., doing about that?
Yeah, it's very true. And sadly, this is something that everybody should be aware of, is that the U.S. is a significant market for ivory, relatively speaking, not on the comparison with, say, China, but there is a legal market for ivory in the U.S. in antique specimens, and it has caused us some problems with poor regulations in the U.S. in controlling the trade. And so if you go on certain websites, very popular websites, in fact, some of them, that are trading fashion items, you will find ivory being sold that is claimed to be antique. Now, when we dig down and we delve into this issue, we will actually find in some cases that this ivory is not antique at all. It's being manufactured to look like antiques in countries like China, and it's then being sold into the U.S. via the Internet trading sites where people think they're buying a local antique ivory product from their local state, and in fact it's being smuggled in from another country overseas. So it is happening. We ask that everybody look out for this. We're working with some of these internet sites and trading companies to try and wheedle out the illicit ivory and close down the U.S. illicit market too. So it's been evidenced by a number of big cases recently. There was $2 million worth of ivory seized in New York earlier this year with a very weak penalty imposed actually on the traders, which was disappointing. But that's another thing we need to do, is make sure that when these guys get caught, that the penalty really does fit the crime.
Question. Thank you, Crawford. And thank you for all those great questions. I'm going to turn it to Carter now, and we're going to revisit a
question,
topic.
Question, please.
Oh, question, please. Please state your name and where you're calling from.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I've been
waiting
a while.
That's all right. Thank you.
This is for Carter and perhaps also for Crawford. I'm Joe Relak, and I'm in Eagle Nest, New Mexico, in the mountains here. And my question is based on my Ukrainian heritage. What cooperation are we getting, if any, from the previous Iron Curtain countries, and more specifically Russia, in the issues of the big cats, the snow leopards, the Asian bears, all facing extinction?
First of all, Joe, my aspiration for the rest of my life is to live in the mountains in some place like New Mexico, so I'd love to get your advice as I'd end up in a place like that. And it's a great question about Russia. Heads of state matter. Putin has made tigers one of his real causes. In fact, some of the charismatic wildlife of Russia, he has performed all kinds of stunts to raise awareness of their plight. He hosted the Tiger Summit in St. Petersburg a year and a half ago, and Russia has been a world leader in establishing parks in places like the Amur, or the eastern part of Siberia, where the Amur tiger, it's one of its last strongholds. But on the issue of arresting traffickers in wildlife trade, let me turn to Crawford for an answer to that question and the role that Russia and the Eastern Bloc plays.
Yeah, thanks, Carter. It's very true that Putin has had a strong influence. Yet we have had some challenges, particularly with cooperation on the cross-border trafficking between Russia and China through the political issues. But that is improving, and we're working on that. We're trying to get, we've had some success with joint trainings on the border there, and there is a lot more being done. But one thing I really wanted to draw attention to is actually this week, literally, there is a snow leopard ministerial event that has taken place with all the snow leopard range states, including Russia, coming together to work out a plan on how we can protect snowbirds, which are being poached for their skins, which are sold in places like Kabul, Afghanistan, and are being bought by military there. And it's something that they came to some consensus that they saw that the impact of the Tiger Summit, which was something that WWF ultimately was the driver of and ultimately came up with a concept for, was a great model and a great response. And they're looking now to hold a Snow Leopard Summit next September, we believe, that will bring together all of the partners, including Russia, to build and put in place some strong mechanisms to protect snow leopards on the ground, but also to combat the trafficking and the poaching and the trade. And I don't know, maybe Kimberly has been involved actually with a particular project that we're working on with snow leopards. Kimberly, did you want to mention that USAID project?
That's okay, Carter, because I think we're going to have opportunity for two more series of questions. But I'm really glad that you brought us back to big cats, because Carter was going to speak on another focus of our work, and I'm referring to our efforts to double the population of wild tigers by 2022. The next year, the tiger in the Chinese calendar. So tell us a little bit more about the victories for tigers this past year.
Well, I'm going to just talk on kind of both ends of the spectrum. I mean, I think we all know that if you want to double the population of tigers, it starts on the ground in the dozen or so critical sites for tiger populations. And you have to work on those places, and you have to work through communities, national regulations, and ultimately global markets, not just for in the wildlife trade, but also for commodities, whether it's timber or palm oil or whatever, that the growth of which, the production of which, results in the destruction of their habitat. This past year, we've been working really hard in Sumatra. It's one of the hardest places on Earth to work. It's most of the rainforest there is gone. It's been felled because of palm oil, because of timber operations, and it's among the richest forests on Earth, and the Sumatran tiger is one of the, one of the most endangered subspecies. We've been trying to work with the biggest companies in that area, including Asia Pulp and Paper, for decades now, and we've had agreements which have been broken. We've had commitments which lasted for only a small period of time, and finally this year, even though we have, as a signature of our work, proactive work with companies on their footprints and how they source raw materials, in the case of Asian Pulp and Paper, we took an extraordinary next step, which is we tested their paper products for the content. We established that the content of their two most fastest-growing paper products, which is toilet paper in the United States, contained Sumatran rainforest. And we took that information and we went to the biggest retailers in the United States and gave them 3 months, essentially, to either remove the product from their shelves or be named on our website as one of the retailers carrying this product with the consequences we've talked about. And within that three-month period of time, 90% of those retailers dropped the product. They removed it from their shelves and thanked us for making them aware of the consequences of sourcing that product. And the ongoing engagement with Asia Pulp and Paper is really important to us, and we're really proud of the difference that we've made. But if I think on the other end of the spectrum about sites where we've seen things change, one of those sites is Bardia. It's a little park on the western edge of the Terai in southern Nepal. It's a place that I visited a couple of years ago. It is a place where the tiger population in 2008 stood at 18 tigers. And this year, the recent census showed that population has grown to 46. And one of the heroes of that story is a female tiger who, a famous picture was taken of her and her four cubs, that was 3 years ago. It was really an extraordinary thing that she had a litter of four, and they all survived. She's just given birth to another litter of another four, And at that rate, the future looks pretty bright indeed.
Thank you for that, Carter. So we've reached our second opportunity for questions. If you're asking your question directly, we ask that you state your name and where you're located before asking your question. And remember to press *6 to unmute your phone. As a reminder, you can also email your questions to calls@wwfus.org or ask your question via Twitter using @WWFcalls. Crawford, we'll also stay on the line. Does anyone have a question for either Crawford or Carter?
Yes. Can you hear me? Glenn Absoloff, Columbus, Ohio.
Hi, Glenn. Yes, thank you.
I just have a question for Carter. I wrote, I don't want to get off on a tangent. This is actually a U.S. wildlife concern, and it was something I wrote in a letter in January and then in March and never received any reply. And I was just wondering whether there's some way other than writing letters to get a reply about concerns of related to wildlife.
Hey, Glenn, I'd love to follow up with you after the call, and I apologize that you never got a reply. That's not we make it a standard to reply to people who write to us expressing whatever kind of concerns. So what I'd love is to make sure that we follow up with you right after the call on whatever your concerns were. I've got to go straight into a call at 1 o'clock when we're done, but if somebody could stay on the call with you when it's over, I'd love to make sure we follow up. Is that all right?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
Great. Would anyone else like to ask a question? Well, we have one that came via email from Gary, and he's asking, we were talking about cats, he was asking about our 20-year goals and the fact that he doesn't see the cheetah featured, given that it's the sole member of its genus, it's endangered and or vulnerable, and with a decreasing population trend. Carter, can you tell us a little bit more about how we set our priorities and what some of those species priorities are for us?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I was in London last week with head of sustainability for Boston Consulting Group, and he made an interesting observation. He said, for most businesses, money is not the problem, opportunities are. And within WWF, opportunities aren't the problem, money is. And the greatest challenge for us is actually setting priorities and sticking to them so that we can make sure that we devote enough time and resources to actually make any dent in the problem. And we tried very hard to set priorities as an organization, you know, because of the importance of landscape to not only target species, but many others in human communities. Kind of the centerpiece of our priority setting has been places. It's been, you know, 5 years ago, we really focused on 19 places around the world, places like the Amazon, the Congo, Namibia, the coastal East Africa, and many others, and relied on those priorities to enable us to take action not just for those species we feature, like tigers and rhinos and elephants and whales, but also for those that we don't. And so, we only have one major global initiative on only one animal, and that's tigers. A lot of the other species are swept up in the wildlife trade issue. Thankfully, cheetahs aren't as prominent in that as some of these other creatures are. But beyond that, our hope is that we can contribute
Hello?
To cheetahs.
Thank you for joining. We are in progress. If you'd like to mute your phone, you can press *6, and I'll continue with Carter.
Yeah, so our hope is that we can contribute to cheetah conservation through those place-based programs in places like Namibia in coastal East Africa. And I wish we could make it a priority for every single species on Earth. We've made it make some hard choices, and beyond that, rely on our large landscape work to contribute to the conservation of thousands of species around the world. So,
thank you, Carter. We'll take another question from the callers. You can press *6 to unmute your phone, and please state your name and where you're calling from.
Hi, I have a question.
Great, go ahead.
It's Leslie Coolidge from Chicago. Carter, could you talk a little bit about how you
Hello?
See the relationship with the State Department evolving
Hello?
With Secretary Clinton stepping down?
Excuse
Hello?
Me, Leslie. Hi, you've joined us. We're World Wildlife Fund, and we're in progress. You can press *6 to mute your phone or use the mute function on your phone. Thank you, and go ahead, Leslie.
Yeah, my question was with Secretary Clinton stepping down shortly, how we see the relationship with the State Department evolving.
Yeah, hi, Leslie. First of all, it's great to see the State Department embrace a set of issues. And it's not just Secretary Clinton. It's also Undersecretary Bob Hormats. It's Assistant Secretary of State for Asia, Kurt Campbell. It's USAID and their staff. It is, we got the final calls from the WebEx we did yesterday. I was with Jeff Corwin at the State Department. It was 20,000 people on the line from embassies around the world. So first of all, I had a chance to sit at a roundtable in the lower Mekong with Secretary Clinton in July. She is one of the most impressive people I've ever met. It is a shame, given her commitment to this issue, that she is indeed stepping down. It's interesting. People muse about who is going to be the next Secretary of State. If it were going to be John Kerry, he has a deep and abiding interest in our issues. Susan Rice to date hasn't expressed that much interest in our issues. But my conviction is that no matter who it is, that the depth of engagement at the State Department, from Bob Hormats all the way down, is significant enough for us to continue this work. They see it not as a wildlife issue. They see it as a security issue. They see it as a governance issue. You know, these horsemen in Africa are coming in and killing elephants to fuel the purchase of arms. These crime syndicates are stealing people's wealth. And so it is very much an international governance and security issue as much as anything else. And I think their commitment to this issue will remain.
Thank you so much for these questions. Carter, we lost a conservation giant, Russ Train, recently. He was our founder, a U.S. and international conservation leader, and also a dear friend and mentor of yours. So as we look to the future and think about the next frontier for conservation, how do our plans honor Russ's legacy and carry his great work forward?
You know, it's... I find myself giving career advice to people a lot lately. I think I've talked to 20 young people in the past 3 or 4 months about their careers. And I've gone back to giving them two fundamental bits of advice. One is you should pick the people you want to work with more than the institution, because at the end of the day, the people that you're surrounded with make or break your happiness and your ability to get things done. And the other thing I also say is, before too long in your life and your career, you should get out of Dodge and you should go live in some other part of the world that's not like the place where you grew up, because your decisions and your actions will affect those places far, far away, and they're very, very different. Most of the world doesn't live like we do in the United States. Russ kind of Russ epitomized both issues. First of all, he was all about people. He was a great mentor to me. He never forgot to laugh, but he also never forgot to be absolutely devoted to the next generation of leadership in our work. When we asked him, "How do you want to be honored and remembered?" he said, "Please create a program to train people in the developing world to be the next generation of conservation leaders." And to date, we now have a program called Education for Nature. It's named after Russ, and it has given scholarships to thousands of people And there are the most wonderful stories in places like Zambia and Tanzania and Laos of leaders in those countries who got their start because of this program. So when I think about Russ, in the first instance, I think we really need to double down and devote ourselves to training leaders in these countries where it matters most. And the other thing I think about Russ is, you know, he was one of the grand old men in conservation, a living national treasure. He won the Medal of Freedom and walked up and down our hallways in pinstripe suits and seersucker suits with a handkerchief jutting out of the pocket, but always pressing and prodding our staff to get stuff. And at the end of the day, he was not a traditionalist in that he always leaned on convention. In fact, one of his hallmarks was that part of our work should be breaking convention. It should be all about inventing new things and having the courage to go out and try new things that don't make you popular, that aren't about raising money per se, but are about doing the right thing and having the conviction to do so. And so I think, you know, we can honor Russ by building capacity in countries and by continuing to innovate and not do just what people expect us to do, but to go beyond that and do the unexpected.
So thinking about the scale of WWF when he founded it and was our leader here, and thinking about the next
frontier. Can I make a comment on the call?
Hi, you are on the call. Thank you for joining us.
I wanted to give a message.
Oh, please send us your message. What is your name and where are you calling from?
I'm Dr. William Vandervoort from Las Vegas, Nevada. And I wanted to make a comment about non-traditional areas that I think are important.
Go right ahead, Dr. Vandervoort.
During the weekend, I read the Wall Street Journal. They mentioned that Africa is now twice the size of the United States. Its economy is booming. Agriculture is booming. And areas of growth are profound. So I bring up the question of, are we looking ahead on the future of protecting the animals, not just poachers, but from civilization? The price of land is going up, fishing is going up, industry is going up, and in addition to that, medical care is going up. Well, once we get improvement in malaria, TB, HIV, hepatitis, the population will go up dramatically. So we have to be planning now for the future in Africa for the animals, or they won't have any place to go. This is Dr. Vandervoort. I thank you for letting me say this, and I don't have a computer, so I can't go through the usual channel.
No, I appreciate your comment. And you know, what you describe, which is the trajectories of population growth and consumption on the planet, or what I call the irrefutable math of the planet, which is we have 7 billion people now. All the models say they're going to grow to 9 billion probably by the end of this century. They are, as these economies grow, more and more people want to live like we do here in the United States, which places ever greater pressures on wildlife and these places that we cherish. And it is an enormous imperative for us to do two things. One is to make sure that wild places persist and that we create parks and community conservancies like the ones I saw in Africa, where animals and people can coexist in a way that is conserves animals. But the other thing we need to do is also make sure that when we look at food production and we look at energy production and we think about water, that we find new, more efficient ways to meet our needs while using less land, energy, and water along the way. And so there's an imperative to make sure that we keep those places that we cherish, and we also find a way relentlessly to find a way to meet our needs, whether it's feeding people or putting a roof over their head, using less land, energy, and water along the way. And I'm happy to report that we're making progress in both areas. We just in Africa just last month created the largest marine protected area in Africa with the government of Mozambique. It's called Primaris and Secundus, and it captures the richest islands and coral reefs off the coast of that country. And I'm also pleased to report that we are working with companies like Mars and like Coke and like Walmart in thinking about their footprint in Africa and how do they source products in a way that has a lighter footprint on the land. But, you know, I think on this last trip I took, I had a chance to travel. I was in South Africa, Namibia, Angola, Botswana, and Zambia. And I saw people on the ground who were making an enormous difference. But I also was able to see this breathtaking new initiative called CASA, where those five countries, actually Zimbabwe was the fifth, have come together to commit to reestablish migratory patterns for hundreds of thousands of elephants, to pull down some of the fences that divide these countries, and to establish wildlife as a land use that is just as important as agriculture, particularly because local communities make money off of wildlife through ecotourism and other means. So, you know, I think they're reflecting on this past year and also reflecting on the future, helping initiatives like CASA succeed is really important. The other place in the world that I think is that I had a chance to spend 10 days in is Burma or Myanmar. And I was there 2 weeks before the president visited. I had a chance to float down the Irrawaddy, to meet with scientists in Mandalay, to meet with the Minister of Environment in the modern city hacked out of the jungle in Naffy Daw, and then to sit around Aung San Suu Kyi's dining room table and talk about transparency and the rule of law. And finally, to drive up a road, a little dirt road that disappears into the jungles between Myanmar and Thailand, where there are some of the richest, most intact forests in Southeast Asia and hundreds of tigers that still live there. There is, in Myanmar, which has untouched rivers, untouched coastline, and untouched forests, an opportunity to help them get their development path right, to ask the right questions, to establish rule of law. And in the case of that last forest I mentioned, to work with Thailand and work with us to craft a development plan. You know, it's interesting. Bangkok wants to build a 6-lane highway connecting Bangkok with the Sea of Andaman right through those forests because it's their version of the Panama Canal. It shortens the transport their ships have to take. They don't have to go all the way down to Singapore and around, and it opens up a whole new market. There is a huge opportunity for us to help Myanmar both design infrastructure and map their nature and help their write their regulations so they can keep those areas intact that are fundamental to their future prosperity, but also intrinsically bound up in the cultures and the lives of the ethnic minorities in that country. Amazing place, amazing opening, and a chance for us to get some things right.
Thank you, Carter. So we're going to take our final opportunity for some questions. I'm going to first go to one that came in via email asking about what WWF is doing about shark finning and those problems. And so I was wondering if you could also talk a little bit about WWF US and the role that we also have within our WWF network in engaging about shark finning.
Sure. Is Crawford still with us?
Crawford, are you still there?
I am here, yes, Carter.
Okay, Crawford, I'm going to toss this to you because you've spent so much time on shark finning and also thinking about the campaigns. I wonder if you could just comment on this issue where we are beginning to see some serious progress, and not just in the U.S., but China as well, where we've lent our voice.
Yeah, thank you, Carter. There's several approaches to dealing with the shark trade, shark fin trade, and, of course, one of those, as Carter suggests, is working in Asia to reduce the demand through awareness work, and there has been some very good progress there with with outreach approaches. So we're seeing some tides turning here, absolutely, and we're seeing hotel chains, we're seeing airlines, we're seeing famous chefs and restaurants all saying we will no longer be serving shark fin, which is traditionally used for very important banquets, particularly weddings and so on, where shark fin just has to be served, shark fin soup. It really is changing now, and we're also finding that some people are developing alternatives to shark fin that are don't contain any part of a shark or even an animal, in fact, that are quite apparently effective, very authentic alternatives to shark fin that are just like the real thing. Some chefs are pioneering that, and that word is getting around too. So that is really growing. But it's not just also the market side of things. There's also a number of initiatives to protect sharks from this trade. And in fact, you know, legislative, regulatory processes can always be very helpful. A number of states in the U.S., for example, are banning shark fin trade and imports. But it's happening too in many other countries where people are starting to ban shark fin trade. In the CITES process, as I mentioned before, the international treaty that deals with trade in wildlife, there is a series of proposals being put forward with a lot of backing and support by governments in Europe and the U.S. particularly, but also some less traditional partners like some of the Central American countries that are proposing to protect a number of shark species, including three hammerhead shark species, oceanic whitetip, and the poor beagle shark that really are suffering terribly from a very poor fisheries management process that is leading to some dramatic and drastic declines in their populations, you know, in the sort of 90% range decline for some of these species, which is just phenomenal and very concerning. So the plan is to get these species under international trade regulation, understand the dynamics, set in place quotas for trade potentially when the trade is looking very damaging, and try and close down the worst parts of the trade, because it's such a massive global problem with vast volumes of fins being traded on an annual basis.
Those are the two main
pushes right now.
All right, thank you, Crawford. Carter, we're running out of time. I'd love to turn it to you just to wrap it up and say goodbye.
So I wanted to thank everybody for joining us. A lot of good questions today. I was taking my son to school today, and we were talking about gratitude. I said to him, there are several qualities that I admire in people: intelligence, kindness, resourcefulness, and gratitude. And I said, I was reflecting on Thanksgiving because it's a moment where we can take stock of what we have and also reflect on our relationship to others. And I wanted to just take a moment to just say how grateful I am for all of your help with our work. We couldn't do anything without your support. Your financial support means the world to us, but also your lending your voice to our cause in the many ways that you do that makes a huge difference as well. We are a civil society organization. Our voice is really important. And I just wanted to express my gratitude for all that you do to help us on the issues that we talked about today. So just happy holidays to everybody, and thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much, Carter and Crawford, for joining us on the call and for your insight into our work. We also want to thank everyone for joining us today. I'm also grateful for the many, many questions we got via email and Twitter, and we apologize for not being able to answer them all directly, but we will follow up with you. And if you have further questions, please email calls@wwfus.org. That's calls@wwfus.org. You may also call Clara Fisher at 202-495-4729. That's 202-495-4729. 4729. Glenn will also remind you, please go ahead and send your contact information so we can follow up on your question. And if you'd like to share this call with a friend or hear it again yourself, it'll be available as a podcast in about a week at www.worldwildlife.org/calls. If you'd like more information on WWF's work around the world, you can visit our website at www.worldwildlife.org. We hope you'll join us for our next call in March, and thank you again for joining us today, and thanks for your continued support of World Wildlife Fund.